One of the main ways that the general public interacts with volcanoes is through news and media. And how effective that communication is depends on accurate, reliable, and interesting journalism. Whether that's from the worrisome, to the wonderful, to the downright weird side of volcanoes. And so I'm very excited today to be joined by Dr. Robin Andrews, science journalist, popular science author, and volcanologist. Hi, Robin.
Hey, Sam. Thanks for having me. Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you as well. Thank you so much for joining us today. Like I just said, journalism is such an important part of anything to do with not just volcanoes, but natural hazards and science in general, because it's the main way that people come face to face with it, even if it's just through their TV screen, through their phone, through the newspaper. And it's just such a critical part. So I'm so glad to be able to talk to you about this today.
Ah, good to talk about it. Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
So as a great way to start this off, it would be good to know a bit more about your background and how you've got to where you are today, because you started your journey in from more of an academic side of thing, but you found yourself thrown into the world of journalism.
Yeah, so I don't have any journalism training. Journalism was not something that like came up at any point during my multi-decadal quest to become a volcanologist, because I didn't really have a very concrete plan. I was inspired by volcanoes in video games and some very supportive geography teachers, basically, to do volcanology, because I just thought, you know, there aren't any volcanoes in the UK, so it means you get to go to interesting places and study these exploding mountains. But academia wasn't really for me, just because I'm quite an impatient person, and as much as I love doing aspects of the PhD, I kind of learned that I prefer telling non-scientists about volcanoes rather than just focusing on like one thing to do and worrying about grant money and stuff like that. I just wasn't very good at that, and I hated writing academic papers. I hated it because every now and then I put in like a bit of flowery language to just try and just make the text seem a bit less flat, even though I understand why it's supposed to be, you know, very, very to the point. And my supervisor was always like, no, stop it. You know, slapping my hand out of the way, metaphorically. And it was just like, oh, okay. So I kind of just winged writing like random blog posts and things, and just one thing led to another. And eventually I got to be a full-time freelance science journalist, which is still a weird thing because it was completely improvised on the spot. There was no grand plan to do it. It was just like, oh, I really enjoy this. I'm going to keep doing this and see if I can make a living out of it. And that was all the plan I had. So thanks, editors, for letting me write about stuff.
And probably not something that you'd recognize as a viable career at finishing up a PhD and doing like straight up volcanology.
Yeah, no one at any point in any way mentioned that this was a possibility. Basically, it was that kind of, as I'm sure a lot of PhD students are familiar with, is the idea of like, you're already doing a PhD, you obviously have to, you're on the ladder now, you're down this kind of labyrinth of, you have to get to the center of the maze and you have to keep going. And anything else was kind of broadly considered as like a failure of some sort. You know, there was this like, well, you know, it's the publish and perish thing and all the other kind of stuff that comes up with that. And I'm amazed at the persistence of people kind of get through that. And I know some people have harder times than others sort of thing, but it was, yeah, I mean, my supervisor and his colleagues and everything were just sort of like, what else would you do? Like, why would you do this if you didn't want to be in academia sort of thing? And I was, so you kind of have to make it up. Like, who do you talk to? What happens? There was no really advice given. So it was just kind of fluky.
You know. So how did you even find yourself in, you know, that very first writing gig, so to speak? How were you discovered?
I mean, it took a little while. It took a little while because I started writing just random blog posts just for the fun of it during the PhD. So I just wanted to write something that wasn't just academic text. And I think like after my PhD, there was a sort of year of like, well, what am I supposed to do now? Kind of thing, you know, how does this work? But eventually, I just sort of aggressively emailed a few outlets like Gizmodo and Nat Geo and was like, hey, you should let me write about this thing. Because this stuff about Yellowstone is crazy and silly. And this is more interesting than that. And I think just by saying, hey, I have a PhD in volcanology and I think I could write, you know, about it. They just were kind enough to give me a chance sort of thing. So, you know, and once you get in somewhere and you don't mess it up, you can kind of build off that because you can send out of a place like, hey, I wrote about this for Gizmodo. I wrote about this for Nat Geo. And then it accelerated wildly out of control. So like in 2018. So I've only really been doing this full time for 3 and a bit years. But it sort of, once it started going well, it didn't stop, which I'm very thankful for. But yeah, it took a while to get to that.
Because I think I remembered like seeing some more of these journals coming out exactly around that time. And they just kept coming like at a faster pace. It was like a train setting off from the station. And all of a sudden, like my Facebook feed was full of these wonderful well-written volcano articles. It was brilliant.
It's good fun. And it's nice because it's quite a niche. Like there aren't many people that are very, I can only think of one other journalist that kind of regularly writes, okay, maybe two regularly writes like geo themed pieces, even though they can write about other things. One is Paul at Vusen at Science, and Maya Vejheis at Nat Geo, and kind of have different focuses sort of thing. But it is nice that when a volcano erupts or does something interesting, all my editors sort of look at me like, well, you know, yeah, and it's nice to have the expectation that I'll write about something. So I think that's the point. I was like, okay, maybe I'm not terrible at this, I think. But yeah, it took a while. We all have imposter syndrome.
And then for you coming in, say, from a science background, that must have put you in a very different place to the majority of people involved in journalism. Like you said not long ago, your background is not in journalism, but a lot of people are. Did you find that was, you know, your unique twist? Because you can say, as you just said, I have a PhD in this subject. I can give you that I can tell you what information is accurate here, what is not, what is fear-mongering, what's misinformation, and what's interesting and engaging from it.
Yeah, that definitely helps. I mean, I think the best way to describe it, like science is a good way of, especially if you've gone through to do like, well, I don't have to do a PhD, but if you've gone through and done a science degree of any sort, it's a good way of kind of teaching you how to recognize bullshit from reality. And you kind of come to the understanding that just because something's peer-reviewed in a journal doesn't mean it's necessarily good in that way sort of thing, you know, and you kind of helps you read scientific papers so you can read and get stories out of things that people might be like, I've no idea what that means. And you're sort of like, what? But this means this. And it's, you know, it's nice as well when you talk to scientists, you don't have to, there's an expectation that you kind of know the basics, so you don't have to start with like, so what is magma? What's the difference between magma and lava and stuff like that? But that definitely helps. But I think the other thing that my editors pointed out often was that I always seem quite gleeful. And I know obviously you have to be sensitive to certain subjects, but volcanoes are generally considered to be like ominous, doomy mountains. But I was like, but sometimes they're just cool. They just do cool things. And I think that hadn't come across before to a lot of them. This kind of gleeful like thing of explosions and lava and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, okay. I just always thought they were. So yeah, enthusiasm, I guess.
And so one thing you could say is that volcanoes, say they're cool, but they're also super, not as in super volcanoes, but as in your book, Super Volcanoes.
Yeah. Hey, there the title is right there. The title, I mean, like, I have received two angry emails from people going, well, this whole book wasn't about Yellowstone, like, world-ending blah, and someone just said there's not enough death in your book, and I was like, okay. I mean, there have been some popular science books on volcanoes, and they're good, but they're often about things that have been destructive, and I was like, I want to write a book about just, like, the cool things volcanoes. There's a little bit of destruction in there, but mostly it's like, look how cool this stuff is. There's no, you know, look how important this is, how they help us understand entire worlds and everything. So they're volcanoes that are super. But I felt like I shouldn't spell that out very explicitly in the book because I thought most people would get that. Most people do, but two people apparently have not. So I'll take that. I'll take that ratio.
There we go. Yeah. The general public has decided it's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. It's a really fantastic book.
There's
just so much in there in terms of the topics you go through, the people that you talk to, and then just your approach to the subject and just the writing itself, it makes it engaging and not feel like I'm reading, you know, a science textbook, which is probably exactly what the aim is.
Yeah, I wanted it to be a book that was mainly about stories than just like a science explainer thing. There is obviously science in there, but it's not like, here is how these work. It's more like, look at the kind of stories you get from the people who study these things. You know, that's what really interests me. Like when we first spoke for that article in 2019, I think so. Seems like ages ago. Your expedition to kind of help image like the magma within an underwater volcano, and I was like, it's the sort of stuff that's like, it's adventurous but true. You know, so I think it's kind of that really appeals to me. So that's what I was going for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes you get these events, I guess, that it's not just a volcanic eruption that almost plays out by the textbook and by the playbook, how it's meant to happen. But sometimes you get, you know, certain ventures or expeditions that come about that aren't necessarily related to an eruption, but to a volcano, where you can tell the story of the scientists and the story of the journey as well, the very human side and exploratory side of it.
Yeah, and the human side is just as interesting to me as all the kind of science behind it, because they're incredible things to study, volcanoes sort of thing. They're just so fantastical in the sense that they really don't seem real when you hear stories about them, what they can do, and, you know, I don't know. It just, there's such a compelling element to me, like liquid fire, you know. It seems self-evident that they need to be written about, but the people who study them are also fantastic too, so... It's a good combination. And unlike something like hurricanes, like they can be fascinating, but generally like everyone's like, oh no. Oh, bad. Hurricanes are bad. You don't want those coming your way, sort of thing. And earthquakes, terrible. They're, you know, someone said that volcanoes at least give you some warning, but earthquakes are bastards, I think. That's what they said. You know, volcanoes can be destructive, right? But for the most part, they're just great. They just do their thing. They're amazing to look at. They foster cultures and societies and change planets. What else does that? Hurricane doesn't do that.
as you say, when it comes to, you know, approaching this and that balance, you get events sometimes that happen around the world that have no, you know, cultural, societal, even very little environmental impacts, that you can then just go and view them or see the images, and like that's it. There's no thoughts of, oh, I need to consider that this is affecting people, this is having an impact on someone's lives. And those events are probably quite a breath of fresh air for journalists and scientists, because you can just talk about, as you say, the cool aspects of it and just what the science we can learn from this. And if it's, you know, somewhere like recently in Iceland at Fagradalsfjall, where people can just go.
Yeah,
right up to it.
Incredible. Like, honestly, it's one of those things that was such a perfect like eruption, because it just shows you what long-term monitoring and understanding of a sort of volcanic region can do when it comes to these eruptions. Like, at no point, there was some nerves, you know, that if it comes out too close to Grindavik, I think the town I was in, the south sort of thing. But when it started erupting, everyone's like, this is just kind of interesting. Like, people just set up camera and little gigs, wedding proposals. It's great. That's what volcanoes do a lot of the time. But there's that bias, isn't there, that they make the sort of general news when they do something destructive. So that's the image people have in their heads generally, whereas often they just do things and it's fine and everyone gets on with their life sort of thing. So,
yeah,
you know.
And then recently, as of only, I think, a couple of months ago, you know, normally you're writing articles about events or eruptions that are happening, but sometimes you get the opportunity to take a step back and think about, you know, the social effects of this. So you wrote a really interesting, and I'm so glad you wrote this article, about the paradox between finding this stuff cool and interesting, but also, you know, that balance of considering, you know, the ethical balance that you have to have when discussing these things, if they have had an impact on people's lives. I'm just wondering what like came about for you to decide to, you know, write that article.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. One was that when I was writing about, I wrote lots about the 2018 Kilauea, you know, eruptive sequence sort of thing. And that was amazing and devastating in so many ways. And it was, you know, there was like lava nados. I know they were technically like fire whirls, but whatever. They were lava nados. You know, you had like blue fire and you had those like giant billowing clouds and these spectacular lava fountains. But you also had hundreds of homes destroyed and, you know, lots of hearts broken as a result of that. And it was so interesting talking to volcanoes there, either who are already in America or who are elsewhere. And for a lot of younger volcanologists, this was the first time they'd ever seen an eruption like this kind of thing, you know. Not even honestly, a lot of volcanologists had never seen an eruption quite like this sort of thing. And it was just funny hearing them oscillate within minutes from absolute joy of like, oh my God, this is everything I've wanted to see in my entire life. You know, the first time you see lava anyway for anyone is like a transcendent experience. It's so strange and ominous, but awe-inspiring, you know. And then minutes later, they pivot to just how distressing it was when people coming up to them talking about, is this lava going to destroy my home? You know, watching home get destroyed the next day and that horrible kind of side of things. And so that was in the back of my head. And then there was the La Palma eruption that was going on. And I saw some scientists on Twitter, some volcanologists on Twitter, especially, again, younger ones, go to La Palma and be like, this is amazing. I've never seen anything like this. Here's like a lava bomb like rolling down the thing, like Sonic the Hedgehog kind of thing. And then some people are like, it's disrespectful to be that excited, you know, people's homes being lost. And I kind of felt bad for the scientists because I don't think anyone was there with like a malicious intent. Like, yeah, screw these people. It was just this natural, like, you know, this focus on this thing you've been studying and actually seeing this process. And I kind of wanted to write something that was like, I'm pretty sure volcanologists feel both of these things. And there are many things in life where you feel like awe and horror at the same time. It's a weird thing. Like you can within a second jump back and forth, you know?
Yeah. Well, because it's absolutely true.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You get that initial rush of like, wow, which is just a visceral reaction. And then once the social aspect sort of filters in, you're like, oh, this can actually be terrible. It doesn't mean it's one or the other. It's both. And I think there's always this need on like social media to be like, it's one or the other. It has to be one or the other. You know, it's like the whole, we either go into space or we fix Earth. It's just like crap. Like it's, you can do both these things or feel both these things. So that's why I really wanted to write that. So I'm glad my editor let me write it because it was just something that I feel like almost every volcanologist has at some point experienced that. So I'm glad it resonated anyway.
Yeah, and it's important as well for, you know, for the volcanologist to, so that story is heard, and also for public perceptions of volcanologists, and well, not just volcanologists, but scientists, first responders, if anyone who's involved in these kinds of, or geohazard events in general, so that people understand, it's like, no, we are seeing both sides of this, but if we're on the ground as scientists, you know, collecting data, analyzing samples, oh, that is where our minds are going to be sometimes. But within a second, then, you know, people might be helping out with first responders, answering messages from people, particularly if they're down on the scene.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, humans are complex, you know. We don't have an ability to just feel one thing sort of thing. It's, you go through a range of emotions, you know, with anything in life, so... You know, when you're faced with something so otherworldly as an eruption that most of us fortunately don't have to stare down every day, you know, it's not like a common thing. Even for volcanologists, you don't spend your entire life just right next to these things. It's, yeah, I don't know. It needed to be unspooled a bit, I think. As you say, because there was that, you know, it's good to have an insight, like, scientists are human too. You know, they're not just sort of unemotional logic machines. They're definitely not. Yeah.
But so coming back to your book a second, I'm now wondering at the, you know, the transition that came about from you going, you know, from more popular science article writing for like Nat Geo, Gizmodo, the New York Times, to then deciding, no, all of these things I've done over these few years, I want to put this into a book. What was that spark?
I mean, so I'd always had the idea that I wanted to write something like the book that eventually came out, because there were so many grand tales of adventure and intrigue and explosivity, you know, and I was like, this definitely is crazy stories in it. Like, every now and then someone would tell me something off, just like, oh, once Mars tipped over by 20 degrees. And I was just like, that's nuts. Like, this is the sort of thing that, like, why isn't this told to, like, students everywhere? You know, the volcanoes can do this indirectly sort of thing. It's just, anyway, it was stuff like that. And I just thought, I'm just going to store all this in my head. But it was kind of a fluke because I wrote, just for no apparent reason, I wrote an article that had nothing to do with volcanoes for The Atlantic. It was about dark matter and ancient shipwrecks. Just completely randomly. And just agents popped out of nowhere to be like, hey, have you ever thought of writing a book? And I just picked one. It seemed nice. and he's like, okay, we'll put together this proposal. And he's like, what do you want to write about? I was like, there are volcanoes in space and they're cool. And they're, I hadn't thought of the idea properly, but it was kind of just like an organic thing that just kind of came out of nowhere. So that was like, so within 6 months, I had this proposal written up, sent off, and then fortunately it was accepted, you know? And it was, so it kind of came about, I didn't pursue it. It was kind of pursued as a result of someone seeing something I'd written. So that was very, really nice actually, but it was so, like, a book is something I was like, oh, in 10 years, maybe I'll get to write one. So it was crazy that within, it was the first year of me freelancing full time that came up. And I was just like, I cannot believe that this is happening. So yeah, it was kind of a fluke actually. Yeah. So
and
weird.
Actually, as you say, it came about from non-volcano related articles.
Yeah, it was because the article had a sort of narrative to it. And I think it kind of hinted that I could tell stories, rather than just like, here's how a thing works. So I think that's what did it. But yeah, it was really funny because it was on dark matter. I really don't write about dark matter much, but it was, I like writing about weird stuff. Stuff that makes people go, oh, that's cool. And that,
I was going to say, how do you find that transition? You know, going from something that you don't know as much about, because you suddenly have to do probably a lot more research as opposed to when a volcanic eruption happens, you go, okay, I know who I want to speak to. I know the good background of this, and I can do a lot of this myself.
Yeah. It's a lot more difficult when something like that comes up. I'm just like, I don't know who I'm going to speak to initially, and I have to triple check that what I'm saying is right and stuff. With volcanoes, it's kind of all the fundamentals are very clear, and it's a lot. Like, I never worry about writing an article about volcanoes, but if it's something on dark matter, I'm always like, I enjoy it, but it's always like, you know, like, does this mean, I feel kind of silly asking really basic questions, but I'm like, I need to know if I say this, is it okay, sort of thing. But yeah.
But the basic questions that you're asking are probably the basic questions that someone from the general public would also want to ask.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, I mean, I just act as like layman and as possible, even if I have some background, like, oh, I know what an axiom is or something. I'm just like, nope, I'm just gonna pretend I know nothing, so they have to explain it in the most like straightforward way kind of possible, because they need to translate it for me sort of thing. So it's still fun though. I like it. No, it's nice to write about different things, but volcanoes and planets and things are still my favorite, like things with rocks doing kinetic things.
And the network of people you must now have from, not just from volcanoes, but from talking about all kinds of topics that you know you can go back to as reliable sources, or maybe not so reliable sources.
It's normally reliable. Yeah, there have only been a few people I've spoken to, and it's just been like, there's like openly hostile, like, why are you asking that? Or you should know that, you're a volcanologist by training. And it's like, you know, just a very, very, like, literally on one hand, count those people, but like hundreds, I've spoken to hundreds of people, and everyone is normally great and really great science communicators, you know. Especially like younger scientists that are very good at communicating what they do. And I think there's a much more savvy approach to like how you explain stuff to people who aren't scientists, whereas sometimes you get like older scientists who just almost don't care. They don't even care if, sometimes, like if they explain it in a way that you understand, it's like, well, this is how I explain it, so deal with it kind of thing. So the most entertaining interviews are from like, you know, younger cohorts on average sort of thing, you know, so
yeah,
that's interesting.
So, you know, this career comes with its challenges, certainly. And you know, you've just mentioned a couple there. Is there anything that really sticks in mind of, as you know, as a challenge in science journalism?
Every now and then you meet an editor, you think, I'm, oh, I don't know about that. Like, you know, a really good editor. I'm the editors I've got now are just so good. Like, they are so lovely. And I'm not just saying that. They are just so thoughtful and considerate. Any criticism is always constructive. And they always ensure that your voice is kept in. They don't try and, like, neuter your language. And they suggest ideas and you can talk through them. And it's very, like, informal and great. I, you know, love all my editors. But early on, I came across, like, a couple that I was like, this person is just trying to, it's just like they're writing this article and you know, they're like, you have to include the source. And I'm like, no, it's not going to be good. And then you know, you feel like you're being railroaded to do things that you like, this person doesn't seem to understand the point of what I was trying to pitch. And very, very rare examples. But once you know, like, oh no, that's not good. Early on when you don't feel like you've got that much of a reputation, you feel like you have to just work with people that you don't really want to, kind of thing, just to build it up. And now a story comes off, I'm like, oh, I might be a good for that editor, but I'm like, I don't like that editor, you know, or I don't really feel like it. Then I feel like I don't have to do it now. So early on, that was definitely a challenge or thing. And but now it's just like I've got the best group of editors, science editors, like I could possibly want. So it's good, but that does take a while to work out. Like, who do you work best with, and who isn't just like a megalomaniac?
But then I guess also the demands on your own time as well. This is not a Monday to Friday, 9 to 5 kind of job. As much as you could attempt to shoehorn it, because when an eruption happens, you must have a split second of thinking, oh, wow, this has happened. That's cool. Yeah. To a few seconds later, like going, okay, 3, 2, 1. Now I've got to start writing and talking to people.
Yeah, it's been a bit easier during the pandemic because there's less social stuff going on. So you're just saying, it doesn't really matter when it happens, sort of thing. I'm also like, all my editors are in America, almost all of them are in America. So my time zone is normally East Coast, but I'm a night owl anyway. So a lot of that's fine. And I'm quite like improvisational as a person and spontaneous. So like, it's not a job that suits someone who likes rigorous planning and scheduling. You have to think on your feet all the time, like constantly. And like some weeks are like really quiet, and then like something crazy happens. And then like the recent Tonga eruption, that was just like 14 full days of just constant writing and interviews and research. I think I wrote 6 different things on that one eruption sort of thing. And it was just like all on very different aspects. And there's so much going on. It was evolving in real time, but it was kind of like fun. Like, that's what I do. It's good. But you know, it's kind of unsustainable to keep doing that. You need to have a time off to just go like, ugh. But sometimes it ebbs and flows quite dramatically, but overall it kind of balances out. But yeah, trying to, like, you know, now that before Omicron, when social things started to happen again, my brain was just like, all I want to do is just see people, like, but I need to switch that balance. And it's quite an extreme, like, all of the work and then all of the play. I can't really think of a time where it's been like, oh, it's a nice balance of stuff. I'm just confused when it's like, oh, it's weirdly, this is just acting like a normal week. I don't understand. So yeah, it's chaos.
As long as people know that going in.
Yeah, it's pretty chaotic. It's not like, when you have a quiet moment, like, enjoy it, because it suddenly won't be quiet at some point, sort of thing. So it's like, yeah, you have to think on your feet a lot. But if you don't mind that, it's so exciting. I remember I was up in the Arctic just on I was invited to attend something that was about the aurora, and it wasn't for a reporting thing. It was just like, it's kind of like a draw. And like, hey, we can get people up to talk about the aurora from like all different backgrounds. And whilst I was up there, there's a really cool study that came out about an asteroid that could blow itself, if you blew it up with a nuke, it'd reassemble under its own gravity, like the liquid Terminator kind of thing. It's like, oh my God, I really want to write that. So I pitched it while standing on a frozen lake at like 1 in the morning and then ran back to my hostel to write it. And then like just stayed up all night writing it, and then just went snowmobiling the next morning sort of thing. I remember being like, I am exhausted, but I'm so exhilarated that I could just do this stuff like in the art. Like, what a crazy place to write this thing up. And I just remember it so vividly because it was such a weird, you know, and I remember thinking, this is what I want to do forever. It's this. It's just crazy. So, yeah, it seems if you can improvise, then yeah, you just need the internet, basically.
Yeah. So you've mentioned a few things there, but is there anything else, you know, you would say to someone considering, you know, science journalism, popular science writing as a possible career?
Yeah, two things. One is, like, please give it a chance sooner rather than later, because things get harder to do once you go through life later. And I remember thinking, like, you know, should I try this now or should I just, like, I gave myself like a year to just try and make it okay sort of thing. And things fortunately went much better than I thought they would. But I still felt like, give yourself like a year to give it a go. Unless you're going to be like homeless and starving, just give it a go when you feel like you should. Because as this pandemic has really emphasized, life can be very short and you will regret things in 5 years' time if you think, damn, if I only gave it a shot, you know, if it doesn't work out, then okay. But like, at least you know, at least you gave it a try. The other thing is reach out to journalists for advice, because most journalists are very happy to chat to you. Some are kind of closed off, but most science journalists I spoke to are happy to be like, yeah, and you can, here's this person's email, why don't you pitch them? You can say, I recommended you, kind of thing. Like, I owe a fair bit to, she used to write at Gizmodo, and she founded Eartha, but she's moved on as a freelancer herself now, as Maddie Stone. And she just gave me a chance really early on, just because I just simply, and I wasn't even looking at the time, I just said, hey, your articles are great, one day I hope to write articles like this, kind of thing. She said, oh, why don't you try pitch to Gizmodo? Kind of, you know, you seem like you know what you're doing. And help me write, like, understand how features are written and how news articles are written. So, you know, just be nice to writers and they'll be happy to give some time up to help. Like, I would never pay, like, I'd always give people advice for free, because it's often the people that need the advice are just getting started. So I wouldn't, like, be like, yes, give me money. But it's, yeah. So reach out to writers and just dare to give things a go. Like, just practice writing or telling stories that you're passionate about. Like, don't do something you don't want to do. Someone's like, oh, science journalism, you have to write about all kinds of things. Like, I'd never write about, like, genetics. I'd never do it, because I'm just not an expert in that, and it would be so nerve-wracking and awful. So just practice writing what you enjoy telling stories about, and speak to writers, and just see how things go, you know. It's, you'll regret it otherwise, I think.
Good. I think that's a sell if I've ever heard it. Now, so you talked about, you know, standing in the middle of a frozen lake and thinking up of an article about how, you know, asteroids can reassemble themselves. But apart from that, do you have a particular memory or a moment that sticks in your mind, you know, related to, you know, your life in volcanoes?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's while I was in the middle of my PhD, and it was the moment I was like, okay, this is exactly the feeling I want to feel as in a career sort of thing. And it's when I took my parents to see Stromboli erupt. And my parents are, have very supportive parents. They've always said, like, do what you are passionate about, kind of thing, and just, you know, we'll just see how it goes and things. And I always had this interest in, like, volcanoes and that. But when it was halfway through my PhD, we met in Sicily, and I took them to see Stromboli erupt. And it was the first time they'd ever seen, like, lava before their eyes sort of thing. And they were so bowled away by it. Like, it really was the seeing is believing, just to be like, this is what I want to do, kind of thing. And actually showing someone, especially two people that mean a lot to me, like, how volcanoes can make you feel, kind of thing. That kind of awe when they're not causing any harm. I remember being like, that's the feeling I want to engender in other people all the time. That means more to me than just kind of trying to understand volcanoes myself. I would rather hear about it from other people. That giving a sense of people, because there's enough misery and crap in the world as it is, giving people a moment of like, wow, that's cool, just was like, that's what I want to do somehow, that. And I think that was a formative moment. I always think about that fondly nowadays when I'm doing this, exactly what I hoped I would, just beyond my expectations or things. So yeah, that I think about that a lot.
Brilliant. That's a perfect way to wrap this up, I feel, as much as we could keep talking about many things.
Yeah.
So if you are interested in reading some of Robin's work, it's best place probably your website.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, robingeorgeandrews.com. Got there before someone else did.
It's a great place just to basically find the majority of it. I mean, you've written so many at this point now. How do you even keep them documented? But the most recent ones, so if there is, you know, an upcoming, well, what I say upcoming, if there's not an upcoming volcanic event.
That's a secret project I'm working on, yeah.
But if there's been a volcanic event, a recent eruption that you might have seen in the news, I would encourage you to look out for Robin's work, because no doubt within a day or two following some event, there will be an article.
Yeah, pretty much. Sometimes on the day, if it's depending on the time zone.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Robin. I really appreciate it. And hopefully that's given people an interesting insight into another way that, you know, people can interact with volcanoes, and also different careers that people might be able to have if they're interested in this area.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me, Sam. And yeah, people can reach out to me in chat if they want as well. Just send me an email or tweet at me or something like that. You know, always happy to speak.
Yep, you can find him at Squiggly Volcano. I've got to ask before is the last point now. Squiggly Volcano, where's that come from?
Yeah, so I got Twitter in 2011. I didn't really see the point of it until, you know, when all those revolutions were happening in sort of the Middle East, and you could get updates on Twitter kind of thing. I was like, oh, I get why Twitter's a thing. But I didn't really get it until I went to see a show with Brian Cox, the physicist, and Dara Brien, and they said, oh, if you tweet us questions during this thing, we can answer them on stage. And I just panicked and set up a Twitter account in the break. And for some reason, the handle was just Squiggly Volcano. I don't know where it came from, but it had to have volcano in it. And squiggly is a silly word, so it just kind of fits. And now I get a little bit of joy every time, like, somewhere very serious, like the New York Times goes, and now for this very serious article by Squiggly Volcano. And it's kind of funny.
I love it. That is not what I was expecting whatsoever, but that is perfect.
That's right.
So on that note, I'll now again say thank you. Thank you for joining us. It's been a really great chat.
Thanks. Good to be here, Sam.
Okay. Thanks, Robin.